BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I might have said to him, I'll be up there Monday. I've got a job to do.
Do you want a toffee?
Yeah.
I don't suppose anyone in here wants a back rub.
My name is Ross Sutherland. This is the sound of me standing in a lift for an hour with what appears to be a minor head wound.
Ow.
Before I can explain how I ended up in this lift, I first need you to understand what happened to the poet Arthur Cravan between 1913 and 1914. A brief recap. Arthur Cravan was the nephew of Oscar Wilde.
He's this literary hero that I never knew that I had.
Man of fashion, chemist, whore, drunk, musician,
this
laborer, painter, actor.
This is the escape artist.
Arthur Cravan!
Arthur Cravan.
The escape artist.
Monsieur Delaunay has a face like an inflamed pig.
Patron saint of the surrealists.
His colours have German accents.
Inventor of performance art.
Oh, asshole!
Fire the starting pistol for modernism.
To understand Dada, to even understand punk rock.
Yes! Arthur Cravan!
Alternative comedy.
A little pose in front of the mirror.
Our most daring performers to date.
I write to anger my colleagues.
Cause a scandal in everything that he did.
You should have a look at Arthur Cravan.
What a cunt!
Escape.
In early 1914, Cravan gained infamy in Paris for his incredibly offensive writing. Cravan's writing style was informed by his other pursuit, boxing. He wanted to take the thrill of boxing, its danger and immediacy and physicality, and bring that into the world of art. Around the same time, Cravan began to concoct a new creative project, an all-new way to disturb the art world, one that wouldn't leave a paper trail. And, as far as I can work out, central to this new approach seems to be the procurement of a gun.
Escape artist.
This is the moment for me when Arthur Cravan really starts to get interesting. This is the moment, I think, when Cravan properly emerges as the father of performance art. At venues like Les Noctambules, posters began to appear promising Arthur Cravan, Le Critique Brutal, who would speak, box, and dance. Cravan was capitalizing on the celebrity he'd gained through his magazine, whilst also raising money for his legal fees. But, as one might have come to expect by now from our boxer poet, Cravan was only advertising part of his intentions, setting up expectations only to subvert them down the line. As with his art criticism, Cravan wanted to confuse the boundary between what was performance and what was real, namely by firing a pistol as he came on stage. The intention, I assume, was to panic the audience into believing the entire performance was in fact a trap to lure and murder them.
Mr. Cravan appeared on the stage dressed in black trousers and dancing pumps, girded with a scarlet sash. He began his lecture by firing a pistol several times.
There can be no doubt that Mr. Cravan, endeavouring to ward off the terrors of a public appearance, had overdone the matter and had put the terrors, frankly, up to us.
He continued by talking, dancing, and boxing with an imaginary opponent, apparently half in joke, half in earnest. In the middle of the lecture, Mr. Cravan threw his portfolio at the people in the first row.
From time to time, he gave burlesque gestures that were not amusing.
The lecture was one long eulogy of athletes, thieves, and madmen, interspersed with violent diatribes against society, hurled at the audience.
I know these are supposed to sound like bad reviews, but at the same time, they still sound kind of thrilling. It seems to me that Craven wasn't so much performing for the audience as much as performing against them, attacking them, the way a boxer might. Craven's last opponent had been the painters of Paris, but now that he had gained some popularity, it seems our boxer poet was ready to pick a new adversary, namely his own fan base. Now it was Craven versus the audience.
He was going to subvert, undermine all expectations of what a performance was, what an audience expected. And he would do something different. He would perplex. He would make trouble.
Whenever an audience started to get a handle on one of Craven's live performances, he'd find a way to change the rules just to show them that they were wrong all along. For example, in 1913, Craven advertised a show saying that he planned to kill himself on stage at the end of the performance. Craven spread the word that he would perform that night wearing only a jockstrap, ending his set by downing a bottle of absinthe, laying his testicles on the podium, and then smashing them with the empty bottle, presumably then dying from testicle trauma. Craven pulled a huge crowd for the performance. It was standing room only, presumably packed with people who hated him just as much as his fans. When the time came for the performance to start, Arthur Craven stepped on stage, fully clothed, and delivered a dry lecture on the author Victor Hugo. I suppose this is kind of a 1913 version of a Rick Rolling video. You know, when a Link promises something salacious and instead you get sent a video of Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up. Or in boxing terms, you could call it a feint. By reinventing himself as a public speaker, Craven found all new ways of messing with people's sense of reality. It made poetry feel more like boxing. There was improvisation, dynamism, perhaps even risk of injury.
Something that I've always been shocked by is how poetry, which is the primary art form that I work in, has absolutely no concern for environment or context. So one of the early performances I did is I gave out a bag of tangerines, and just before I opened my book, I just said, "I dare one of you to throw one of those at me." And I read the poems and no one...
This is Steve Fowler. We met him a few episodes ago when I was training to box.
They were not thinking about the poem I was reading. They were thinking about what the tangerine in their hand was for.
I love it. And I feel accessing that, like, the instability of a poem is what's so wonderful about that live reading. And that idea, like, it's like setting the poem on fire.
A poetry reading uses the material of liveness. It's not about the book being first. The reading is always a simulacra of a book. For Craven, the live experience of literature, that's what he was interested in. He was alive, he's present.
After leaving amateur fighting competition, Steve became a poet and an avant-garde artist. I see Steve's work as a kind of refinement and continuation of the kinds of questions that Arthur Craven was asking with his live poetry experiments.
I went through like a phase of ripping my books up, eating them, handing them out to the audiences. For the past 18 months, I'm not allowed to come up with anything before the day of the performance, and it has to be mostly, if not entirely, improvised to things in the room. So recently I did a performance and there happened to be a massive flower display, so I finished that performance by eating those flowers. I didn't realise flowers are poisonous to human beings, and the Germans were very worried.
I can imagine Arthur Craven thinking of his work in the same way, this desire to create a living poem that only exists in the present moment, and then it's gone. Over time, Craven pushed his poetry experiments even further. He took his performances out of professional venues and into the street. Craven shared his living poetry performances with people who had no idea what was happening. Whether his actions were even recognized as works of art no longer seemed to matter to him. It feels like Craven here is creating a whole new way of working, interacting with his audience in a way that's decades ahead of his time. I've written poetry all my life, but I don't think I've ever tried to create a poem the same way that Arthur Craven created a poem. I mean, I never tried it until I got into that lift.
Ow.
I decided to host my poetry experiment in the lift of a multi-story car park near my house in Peterborough. A lift, I thought, provided a nice, natural, short window for an intimate performance. In the spirit of Arthur Craven, I had to slightly blur what was real and what was not. To that end, I put a tiny bit of fake blood in my hairline, a subtle accent, easy to miss, I think, but just enough to stoke some doubt in my lift mate as to whether they were experiencing art or placating someone with a mild concussion.
You don't have a time, do you?
It's 12:45.
In the evening?
Afternoon.
Okay.
The poem I devised for the lift was... it was very short, really.
You know, it's funny, I was in the lift with Danny Dyer yesterday. You know, it was the strangest day of my life. Do you know, in his hand, he had this this huge gold coin. Sometimes you want to ask questions, but where'd you start?
That's it. That was my poem. I mean, it's no love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, but his poem, it was alive in a way that no poem of mine had ever been before. I could see why Craven might be drawn to the thrill of something like this. The structure was very easy to improvise around too, so I could change the poem to suit whoever walked into the lift next.
Joe, in his hands, he had this sky blue wedding cake.
Okay.
It's just funny, I was in a lift yesterday with, what's her name, Anne Whittaker. Do you know, in her hand, she had this tiny... porcelain
anteater. Sorry, this is actually my stove.
My hope was that by the time that lift's door reopened, each recipient of the poem would exit into a slightly different world. A world where famous people were quietly moving between floors, carrying out mysterious dreamlike missions. Or at least, even if my audience didn't believe it, they'd leave believing I believed it.
Do you know, I was in a lift the other day with Paul O'Grady.
I was once in a lift with Debbie McGee. Yeah.
I guess we all have stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In trying to follow in the footsteps of Craven, though, I think I probably overstepped a few boundaries. I trapped these people in an artwork without their permission. And even with an artwork as benign and underwhelming as mine, that still feels wrong. There's a weird, powerful forces to mess with, and I felt that in doing it immediately. But Arthur Craven had no problem at all with these kinds of transgressions. Over that line is exactly where he wanted to go. So if we're going to try to follow Arthur Craven all the way to his mysterious disappearance in the Gulf of Mexico, we might need to follow that uncomfortable feeling a little bit further. Next time, though, I won't use fake blood that ends up staining my face for the best part of a week. It might be thrilling to turn your life into art, but it would be useful to be able to turn it back off again when you wanted. Or maybe that's always been the problem.
As the ocean cradles the funds, I see in the port on the decks of steamships, among the indiscriminate merchandise, sailors mixing with stokers, lies, polished machines, a thousand things.
The Escape Artist, Episode 4, The Living Artwork, was written, presented, and produced by me, Ross Sutherland. It was produced for the BBC by Melvin Rickaby, additional voices by Angus Dunnican, and Lizzie Denning. The music was by Jeremy Walmsley.
I'd like to be in Vienna and Calcutta, catch every train and every boat.